From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Sarajevo, the capital of neighboring Bosnia, is where World War I began. World War II and the Holocaust engulfed this region. In both wars, Europe was slow to recognize the dangers, and the United States waited even longer to enter the conflicts.
NATO bombs Yugoslavia. President Clinton explains why. We'll get reaction from around the world. Also, Britain rules the former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet can be extradited to Spain, but not for crimes committed before 1988. We'll find out why. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Bracing for a second day of NATO attacks, Yugoslav authorities today said 10 people were killed and 38 wounded in yesterday's thundering waves of strikes intended to force a peace pact with rebels in Kosovo. Air raid sirens blared today, and the state news agency reported more fighting in Kosovo. It was not immediately clear if further NATO attacks took place in daylight after a night of cruise missiles and bombing strikes on military airports and other targets. The Yugoslav Defense Ministry, in a statement today, called the NATO attacks an unprecedented criminal act that support ethnic Albanian, quote, terrorists. The airstrikes were NATO's first attack on a sovereign country in the 50 years since the Western Alliance was formed. Western officials promised further strikes, saying the campaign would end only when Milosevic's military had been crippled or if he capitulated and agreed to the peace deal already accepted by the ethnic Albanians. NATO Secretary General Javier Solana said on France's Europe 1 radio, the first phase of the bombings likely would continue for several days. Witnesses saw smoke rising from a military airfield north of Belgrade after air raid sirens sounded at mid-morning today in the capital, along with the Serbian town of Kragujevac and Pristina, the capital of Kosovo. Residents of a southern suburb of Belgrade sheltering in a basement said they felt a tremor this morning shortly after air raid sirens sounded in the city. Independent and state-run papers in the Yugoslav capital reported the NATO bombing killed an undetermined number of women and children, including family members of Yugoslav army officers living in military buildings because they were refugees from past wars in Bosnia and Croatia. A NATO spokesperson in Brussels, Belgium, would not comment on the report. Pristina was without electricity and water all night, although power was restored at about dawn today. The center of the city was virtually deserted today, with all shops and stores closed. Across Yugoslavia, aircraft of 8 NATO nations struck military bases, factories, and air defenses with cruise missiles and aircraft. NATO said all aircraft returned safely, rejecting persistent Yugoslav claims that 2 had been shot down. Meanwhile, Serb government officials have ordered all reporters from countries involved in NATO air attacks against Yugoslavia expelled immediately. A government statement accuses the foreign media of disinformation. Last night, President Clinton explained the bombing in a nationally televised speech. This is an excerpt of what he had to say.
Kosovo is the province of Serbia in the middle of southeastern Europe, about 160 miles east of Italy. That's less than the distance between Washington and New York, and only about 70 miles north of Greece. Its people are mostly ethnic Albanian and mostly Muslim. In 1989, Serbia's leader, Slobodan Milosevic, the same leader who started the wars in Bosnia and Croatia and moved against Slovenia in the last decade, stripped Kosovo of the constitutional autonomy its people enjoyed, thus denying them their right to speak their language, run their schools, shape their daily lives. For years, Kosovars struggled peacefully to get their rights back. When President Milosevic sent his troops and police to crush them, the struggle grew violent. Last fall, our diplomacy, backed by the threat of force from our NATO alliance, stopped the fighting for a while and rescued tens of thousands of people from freezing and starvation in the hills where they had fled to save their lives. And last month, with our allies and Russia, we proposed a peace agreement to end the fighting for good. The Kosovar leaders signed that agreement last week. Even though it does not give them all they want, Even though their people were still being savaged, they saw that a just peace is better than a long and unwinnable war. The Serbian leaders, on the other hand, refused even to discuss key elements of the peace agreement. As the Kosovars were saying yes to peace, Serbia stationed 40,000 troops in and around Kosovo in preparation for a major offensive and in clear violation of the commitments they had made. Now they've started moving from village to village, shelling civilians and torching their houses. We've seen innocent people taken from their homes, forced to kneel in the dirt and sprayed with bullets. Kosovar men dragged from their families, fathers and sons together lined up.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As President Clinton addresses the nation in a speech last night explaining the NATO attacks. We'll continue with that speech for just a few minutes.
Cold blood. This is not war in the traditional sense. It is an attack by tanks and artillery on a largely defenseless people whose leaders already have agreed to peace. Ending this tragedy is a moral imperative. It is also important to America's national interest. Take a look at this map. Kosovo is a small place, but it sits on a major fault line between Europe, Asia, and the Middle East, at the meeting place of Islam and both the Western and Orthodox branches of Christianity. To the south are our allies, Greece and Turkey. To the north, our new democratic allies in Central Europe. And all around Kosovo, there are other small countries struggling with their own economic and political challenges. Countries that could be.
This is President Clinton explaining the NATO strikes last night. We're now going to go live to a press conference being held by NATO Secretary General Javier Solana.
In this Europe, at the end of the 20th century, the responsibility for the current crisis rests with President Milosevic. It is up to him to comply with the demands of the international community, and I strongly urge him to do so. Let me now turn to General Clark for his update.
Thanks, Secretary General. As the Secretary General said yesterday, we began Operation Allied Force. It's the first alliance-wide air operation of its type, taken in response to the deepening
NATO General Wesley Clark
unfolding in Kosovo as Yugoslav military and security forces continue and intensify their attacks on their own people. The purposes of this operation have been well articulated by the Secretary General, by the heads of state and government of many nations throughout the alliance. But the military mission is to attack Yugoslav military and security forces and associated facilities with sufficient effect to degrade their capacity to continue repression on the civilian populace and to deter further military and security actions against their own people. We aim to put his military and security forces at risk. We're going to systematically and progressively attack, disrupt, degrade, devastate, and ultimately, unless President Milosevic complies with the demands of the international community, we're going to destroy these forces and their facilities and support.
That is the NATO Supreme Commander Wesley Clark, following the NATO Secretary General Javier Solana explaining what NATO's intentions are in the mass bombing of the former Yugoslavia. We're now going to go first to Belgrade, where bombs have been exploding throughout the night. We're joined from Belgrade by Lepa Mlajnovic. She is with the group Women in Black that has been protesting weekly in the streets of Belgrade. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lepa.
Hi.
Wow, I'm really amazed that we have such a good line to you in Belgrade. We often don't have such a good line when we're speaking to someone next door. Can you tell us what the situation is right now in Belgrade? Have you been hearing bombs exploding?
Well, The general situation is that some people feel fear and some feel less. And it is true that especially people who live in the suburbs close to the military targets, that they have felt very strong detonations and have seen fire and different whatever. And so in those places, most of them were in shelters and cellars all night. During the day, this morning there was again some bombing somewhere. Anyway, there was sirena, so some people were again very frightened. And there is no bread, there is no milk, and some shops are closed. And that's the general feeling around the town.
What is your response to the NATO airstrikes?
Well, we pacifists are anti-military, so we definitely cannot support airstrikes. There is no way. We are practically now, especially the pacifists from Belgrade, we are mostly worried for people in Kosovo. Because there is a huge possibility that the Serbian army, in their politics of vengeance against NATO, in fact starts another phase of aggression against Albanians in Kosovo. And I have talked to some friends last night in Pristina, and they are feeling very, very, very anxious. They are practically afraid to walk out on the street, practically. And of course, every single news is making them fearful. First of all, the only city which didn't have electricity last night was Pristina, so that was purposely done by regime. So Pristina didn't have electricity, which of course makes people more fearful. And second, all the news of the people who can see CNN and BBC in Pristina, they can hear all different kinds of pro-violence hypotheses. So some of them obviously said that there will be ethnic cleansing. Some of them said that all Albanians are going to be killed. Some of them said different words, which were very apocalyptic. So people were afraid again. And then this morning when they found out there is no bread, it made them more fearful and afraid, I mean. So the situation is very complicated down there. And it's true that there is lots of soldiers, Serbian soldiers and troops, and all concentrated down there.
We're speaking to Lepa Miladinovic, who is with the group Women in Black, protesting in the streets of Belgrade weekly for a period of time. Can you tell us what you've been protesting and how you think Slobodan Milosevic can most effectively be dealt with?
Well, first of all, Women in Black is women's peace group, and our vigils are always... First of all, against Serbian regime and their involvement in war and any kind of aggression. That's our main aim. And second, against any kind of anti-militarism, any kind of militarism. And then third, our politics is always oriented to spread solidarity with women coming from the zone against with which the regime is making enemies. So we are now trying to make all different kinds of connections with our friends in Albanian friends in Kosovo to ask them how they are and to talk to them and to just be in touch with them constantly. That's practically the first aim of what we've been doing yesterday and today. That was the most important one.
When we spoke last night, you said that independent radio had been cut off by the regime.
Yes.
What is that independent radio, and was that a reliable source of information?
Yeah. Well, it was the independent radio from Belgrade, And practically what it did is one of the reasons, well, they would have been cut off anyway, but it was true that, for example, the independent radio announced the Solana's announcement about the NATO strikes. This was the night before yesterday, first of all, and that all the state, all the other media is state control. All the other media is completely state control. So they announced, they gave announcement about Solana's announcement 1 hour after it was done in reality. So they were obviously completely enraged that there is a small independent radio that is completely under, not under their control, that they are just giving all this news whenever they think they should. So they banned the radio, and now the situation is really bad because we can't hear any of the news, what you can hear, just no news, because the all the TV stations, like five TV stations, became one TV station last night, and another three became a second TV station. So all the news are totally controlled, and there are very, very little news in general. So that means that the whole politics of producing hatred, producing language of hatred, producing enemies and new enemies now, is in complete work. It's like every now and then there is very little news, and there is more of this language of hatred, which then makes people. They supposedly we it should produce the whole feeling of vengeance among people.
Let me ask you, Lepa, in the Washington Post today, in coverage of the bombing, it talks about Kosovo being the soul of the Serb region. Do you agree with that? And what do you think is the solution?
Well, you know, this is one of the main rhetorics. I mean, there is a whole, what is interesting here about the regime rhetorics is this intersection of different ages, I would say, because, for example, there is, first of all, the whole Stone Age rhetorics, which says, we Serbs, we shall fight NATO with our bare hands. Then second, there is rhetorics of the 13th and 14th century, where there was a huge battle against Turks in the fields of Kosovo. And there, after that, there was lots of monasteries, Serb monasteries that were built in that region. And therefore, there is this rhetoric, as you are now mentioning, that Kosovo is heart of Serbian culture, that it is a cradle of Serbian culture. And they're using it, of course, they're just using this language in order to explain how the territory of Kosovo belongs to Serbs. And so that really has nothing to do with people's realities, because most of the Serbs have never stepped on the territory of Kosovo, nor do they really know how Albanian people live there, who are they, nor do they have friends there, nor anything similar. So, but there has to be some kind of politics which will make emotion among people, so that they can use them to fight for their own purposes.
We're speaking to Lepa Mladenovic. She is with the pacifist group and feminist group Women in Black. And believe it or not, she is speaking from Belgrade, which is in the midst of the massive NATO bombing, along with Pristina and other cities. When we come back, we'll be joined by an expert on international law, attorney Michael Ratner, and also Jasminka Udovicki, who is co-author of the book Burn This House, The Making and Unmaking of Yugoslavia. I also want to address the issue of, is this the beginning of a more massive conflict, as President Clinton framed it, that it possibly could be, and that if the U.S. had intervened earlier in World War II, he said in his speech last night. Perhaps many more lives would have been saved. Then after that, we'll be going to the Pinochet decision, part two of our coverage. Yesterday, we brought you the Law Lords Live, announcing that Pinochet could be extradited to Spain. Today, we're going to take on the details of their decision and what it all means. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with our guests in a minute.
Oh, my name, it means nothing. And my age, it means less. For the country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up to the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side. All the history books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charge.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Bracing for a second day of NATO attacks, Yugoslav authorities today said 10 people were killed, 38 wounded in yesterday's thundering waves of strikes intended, the NATO forces say, to force a peace pact with rebels in Kosovo. We're joined by three people now. Lepa Mladenovic is with us from Belgrade. She's from the pacifist feminist group Women in Black. On the phone with us from New York, Michael Ratner, an expert on international law with the Center for Constitutional Rights. And joining us from Boston, Yasminka Udoviki, co-author of the book Burn This House, The Making and Unmaking of Yugoslavia. Michael Ratner, can you explain the legal context for this airstrike and if you think it does violate international law or not?
Well, I mean, you know, there's actually no really sufficient legal claim by the United States or the NATO allies that they have the authority to engage in this bombing. The legal context is that force can only be used when the Security Council agrees to the use of force under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter. It's the only way other than in self-defense. What happened here is NATO, really at the behest of the United States, obviously, went ahead and ignored the United Nations and just said, we're going to use aggressive force despite the fact that we don't have the authority of the United Nations. It's flatly illegal. It's considered a crime of aggression, actually, and there's no authority for it. It's the fact that NATO approved it doesn't help them at all. Really, once the UN Charter went into effect, it really meant to provide that force should only be used other than in self-defense with the agreement of the Security Council. They don't have that here. They couldn't get that here, and they're therefore undertaking a clearly illegal bombing.
What does that matter, actually? We talk about bombing after bombing being illegal. What difference does it make?
Yeah, well, it matters. It should matter to all of us, because what we're seeing now is we're basically seeing the United States think of itself as the United Nations. The United States is thinking of itself as, which it is, the only superpower, and it now believes, whether it's in Sudan or in the every-other-day bombing of Iraq without UN authority and now in the daily bombing of Serbia, that it can decide the use of force. And what it means when it's illegal is not just that it's a war crime, but that it's really saying that a superpower country can decide to rule the world on its own without multilateralism and without the consent of other nations. Quite a dangerous precedent, one that the United States obviously wants to have and is going to establish. And we're looking forward in the next decades, I think, to a United States that's going to continue this way of ruling the world, which the effects are, when you can have an easy use of force like that without continuous debate in the UN, without votes on it, force becomes much more easy to use. And that's what we've seen by the United States. There's no restraints on it. The one thing about the Security Council, the one thing about debates, is that people make more measured decisions. They take more time to do negotiations, as I think should have happened here. And the results are a lot more people killed and a lot more bombs falling. I think, the Clinton speech yesterday I found to be just extraordinary on this. It made me think that there's much less justification here than Clinton is trying to claim, because what he did was he basically put this into a World War II context, which I find remarkable. He said this place is 70 miles from, that Kosovo is 70 miles from Greece, 160 miles from Italy, that this is the crossroads of, three continents, et cetera, et cetera. He made it look like we were about to engage in World War III unless we went in there. A very, very exaggerated viewpoint, one that really, though, underlies, I think, what the United States is saying here. I think they're saying we want to keep this place European. We want this as part of Europe. And he practically said that. We don't want this as, we don't want the Russians and Serbia, which go toward, Asia. We don't want that. We want this as part of Europe.
Yasminka Udovicki, what is your response to that, co-author of the book Burn This House, The Making and Unmaking of Yugoslavia, that this could very quickly become a larger conflict?
Yes, I agree with Mr. Ratner entirely. If you would allow me, I first want to salute your having included a group from Belgrade, Women in Black, in this broadcast of Democracy Now! It's been very, very rare that oppositional groups and individuals in opposition have had a chance to speak to the American public. And that is one of the reasons, not, of course, the only reason, but one of the reasons why the opposition, in fact, is so weak in Belgrade today. They very, very much need publicity. They very, very much need to be present in the U.S. media. Regarding the consequences, I fully agree that the consequences can be quite egregious. We see the consequence already in Montenegro. Montenegro has been hit by a bomb. The capital of Montenegro has been hit last night. No one expected that. I did not expect that. Montenegro has built its relationships with the United States. Montenegro has tried extremely hard, the leadership of Montenegro has tried very hard to distance itself from Milosevic. What we have now is, I think, what Milosevic has very cleverly designed. Namely, he will have a divided Montenegro now. Imagine the situation. Your country is being bombed from the outside, and somehow you're still... The citizens, the government is still supposed to applaud the bombers and not side with their own country? Well, they must be seen as traitors. And I'm sure that Milosevic is going to use this and accuse them of that, and that Milosevic is going to turn his forces, police, army, whatever he has, to Montenegro. But more important than that, that the public opinion in Montenegro will see a rift in that public opinion. More and more of the public in the recent, let's say, year or a little more, joined the Montenegrin government that is in opposition to Milosevic. It becomes entirely volatile now. We don't know how it will play itself out in Montenegro. So, in the end, Milosevic may have, in fact, gained a constituency rather than having lost a constituency. That is his calculus. I think that the international powers, the U.S., had to keep that in mind. The U.S., the NATO, had to ask themselves, what could be the calculus of this person who apparently, from all that we can tell, wants the bombing to happen? If you permit me to say another thing, there were other overtures that Milosevic was approached by the Orthodox Church in Kosovo that is very pacifist, that has been trying to interfere and somehow bring about the dialogue. He has been approached by the Orthodox Church not once, but a number of times. He has every time rejected their mediation. The Orthodox Church was saying, we know the Albanians here. We can talk to the Albanians. We can bring about something that you cannot bring with the army and the tanks. He rejected that. All signs were Milosevic wanted the bombing.
Lepa Milojnovic, would you agree with that analysis from Women in Black in Belgrade?
Well, it is obvious that people in Montenegro have been completely surprised with what happened last night. They were practically sitting outside and drinking coffee and couldn't believe that anything like that would happen, because they probably, some of them, not all, but some of them, thought that their politics is clearly against Milosevic's politics. So.
Are you afraid that your group, Women in Black, will become a target of Milosevic, as you are also a target of the NATO strike? Well, you and the entire Belgrade area, target of NATO airstrikes.
No, I'm particularly not afraid, but everything is possible. And also, on the other hand, Women in Black is not a big group, and it's not a big threat for them in general. So if anything happens, there will be that some people might just go to some investigation in police, but we have all already been in police a few times, so probably that might happen again, but I don't think that they are concerned about us in this particular moment. I'm really much, much more worried with the fact that there is no news here, and that people are in a complete isolation of the news, and that they don't even know that there is lots of news circulating around the world, and then people have different opinions about this situation. The problem is that Milosevic is completely producing only news that he wants, so it's really, you don't get news. You get ideology all the time, and it's very little, very little. Like last night, last night there was five TV stations became one, and another three became a second one, and they had three movies from the Second World War. So it's just like, people really don't know what's going on.
Well, on that note, we are going to wrap up. Lepa Milojnovic speaking to us from Belgrade, from the feminist pacifist group Women in Black, which has been protesting in the streets of Belgrade, and Jasminka Udovicki speaking with us from Boston, co-author of the book Burn This House, The Making and Unmaking of Yugoslavia. Michael Ratner has also been our guest, an expert in international law with the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is based in New York. Tomorrow, we're going to take a look at the weapons used in the airstrikes, which corporations benefit from the NATO bombardment of Yugoslavia. Coming up in just a minute, we're going to talk about the decision made yesterday, at least announced yesterday, by the British law lords about Augusto Pinochet, the fact that he can be extradited to Spain. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
With God on its side, the Spanish American war had its day, and the Civil War to us was soon laid away, and the names of the heroes I was made to memorize, with guns in their hands and God on their side.
You are listening to Democracy Now! After deliberating for nearly 7 weeks, Britain's highest court yesterday denied former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet absolute immunity from prosecution, meaning he must remain under armed guard in Britain while a Spanish judge tries to extradite him. And if you were listening to Democracy Now! Yesterday, you'll know we were the only national broadcast in this country that broadcast the Law Lord's decision live. And after our discussion with a number of Pinochet's victims on Democracy Now! Yesterday, they commented that this is getting almost no coverage, the ongoing issue of Pinochet. But today we will continue with the issue. The House of Lords also gutted the Spanish arrest warrant, throwing out all but three of the 32 charges alleging human rights abuses during his 1973 to 1990 regime. An official Chilean report says 3,197 people were killed or disappeared during Augusto Pinochet's brutal 17-year rule. In view of the reduced case, Lord Chief Justice Nicholas Brown Wilkinson called on Home Secretary Jack Straw to reconsider his December decision allowing the extradition process to go forward. Pinochet was arrested October 16th in London on the Spanish warrant, which alleged abuses committed by his security forces after he toppled Chile's elected president, Salvador Allende, in a 1973 coup. The Lord's decision left only three counts of torture, conspiracy to torture, and conspiracy to murder. In his opinion, Brown Wilkinson wrote, "There's no real dispute that during the period of the Senator Pinochet regime, appalling acts of barbarism were committed in Chile and elsewhere in the world." But he agreed with his colleagues that Pinochet could not be held accountable for acts of torture committed before 1988, when Britain signed the Torture Convention. Most of Spanish magistrate Baltasar Garzón's case consists of allegations well before that time. Judge Garzón said he is studying the ruling and offered no immediate comment. Immediately after the ruling, Pinochet's lawyers went to the High Court to appeal Straw's December decision allowing the extradition process to go ahead. The court said the appeal would be considered on Monday. We're going to first go to Spain to get the response of this decision from Joan Garces, who is the attorney who represents over 3,000 plaintiffs, victims of Pinochet, and family members of those who were killed and disappeared. You're speaking to us from Madrid, Joan Garces. Can you tell us what the response is there?
Well, we are certainly studying the verdict, and there are several important technical questions to be decided, particularly concerning persons that have been arrested and are now missing, have disappeared. This crime is still alive. It's a permanent crime as far as the bodies are not found. And the international law, disappeared persons, is considered that is under torture. So if the verdict, if the ruling yesterday said that Pinochet must respond is for crimes of torture since September 88, and the crime is still alive, we think that those 200 cases should be considered straight table.
Well, let's clarify for a minute just what this is about. Is this just the basis for the possible extradition to Spain? And then in Spain, you can broaden the scope beyond 1988. We're also joined by Reid Brody, Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, who has been following the Pinochet extradition battle closely. He was at the House of Lords yesterday for the decision. Reid Brody, what is your understanding of what this means?
Well, obviously, on a general level, the fact that the Lords ruled that no one, not even a former head of state, has immunity for these kinds of crimes internationally is going to have a great repercussions and is going to inspire victims all over the world. In this particular case, the Lords have made a very narrow ruling. They have said that while Pinochet has no immunity, that under Britain's extradition law, Britain can only extradite General Pinochet to Spain for crimes that could have been prosecuted in Britain at the time they were committed, and has said that since Britain only incorporated the Torture Convention in 1988, meaning that torture in another country like Chile only became prosecutable in Britain in 1988, that Britain could only extradite General Pinochet to Spain for acts of torture and for conspiracy to commit torture committed from December 1988 until 1990. And that's a very narrow ruling. However, what we take heart in as a practical matter is the fact that they have left in the conspiracy charge. As those of us who have worked in the civil liberties community know, a conspiracy charge leaves open the possibility for a prosecutor to present a wide range of evidence, for instance, to show that General Pinochet established a secret police, that he ordered the carrying out of assassinations and torture of political opponents. Right now, the battle here is over the next decision that the Home Secretary, Jack Straw, is going to have to make as to whether to allow this case to proceed. And we are arguing that there's a lot left to go on.
Reed Brody, Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. He's in London. Joan Garces is joining us from Madrid. We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We'll be back with them, as well as a representative of a group based in Paris that recently conducted a study showing that the Chilean judicial system could not possibly try Pinochet if he were simply returned to Chile. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
The First World War, it came and it went, and the reason for fighting I never did get, but I learned to accept it with pride. For you don't count the dead when God's on your side. In the 1960s came the Vietnam War. Can someone tell me what we were fighting for? So many young men died, so many more.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our discussion about the Britain's highest court ruling yesterday that former Chilean leader Augusto Pinochet is not immune from criminal prosecution for human rights abuses during his last years in power and must remain under house arrest pending further legal proceedings. We're joined on the telephone by Joan Garces, attorney from Spain who represents over 3,000 plaintiffs, victims of Pinochet and family members of those who were killed and disappeared. Many of those victims killed before 1988, which is when the law lords say Pinochet cannot be held responsible. But Joan Garces, what would prevent you, once Pinochet, or I should say if Pinochet, were extradited to Spain, to simply going for the gold, going the whole gamut and saying, we are going to prosecute you for all those crimes? What is your relationship with Britain that would prevent you from doing that? We're
Hello?
Just, yes, hi. And Joan Garces, are you still there? Joan Garces? Well, Reed, let me ask you that question. Reed Brody joining us from London, Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. Reed, what about this question that they're saying that this is what the extradition can be considered on this basis, only crimes committed after 1988? But if Pinochet were actually ended up sent to Spain, that they could then try him for the other crimes?
Under the European Convention on Extradition, in fact, as under most extradition treaties, a state can only try someone for the crimes for which he's been extradited. But Spain could request and Britain could consent to a broader prosecution. If the United States, for instance, extradites someone to another country on drug trafficking charges, they can't then add political charges or insulting the president. There's a rule that protects the defendant that you can only be tried for what you've been extradited for. But it is very frequent that a state will request the sending state to agree to wider charges, and there's no reason why they can't do it. The rule that Britain used here, that the rule that the Lords used to whittle down the charges, was not a rule of fairness to General Pinochet. It's not that he didn't know that torture was illegal or that torture shouldn't have been committed. So there's no policy or moral or ethical reason why the charges could not then be expanded with the consent of both countries.
Juan Garces has just rejoined us, Reid, from Madrid, Spain. And I'm going to ask you that question as well. What would prevent you if Pinochet ultimately was extradited to Spain to simply expand and say you are going to go for crimes committed before 1988 as well?
Well, it's a rule in the extradition proceedings that they are requesting country can open the trial only on those crimes against which the extradition has been granted. So it's very important what is the decision that finally will be taken by the extradition tribunal in London.
What have the families of those people killed before 1988 and the people you represent who were tortured before 1988, what are they saying to you now? Do they feel that they've just been cut out of the case?
Well, you should consider that for 25 years they have been fighting for justice. Yesterday, Dr. Cassidy from England was quite clear on this point. She was tortured in Chile, and she said at least someone, some cases will be judged, and maybe he will be condemned. And that will be a satisfaction for many other crimes, a kind of consolation.
Can you explain, Juan Garces, the Condor Plan and whether that fits into the charges that have been left, that have not been thrown out?
As I told you, there is a big question mark here concerning the juridical status of the disappeared person. That is not a murder because the people, the bodies are not found, and they have been arrested, that is documented, and they are missing. So there is a resolution from the United Nations General Assembly in December 92, 18 December, saying that those cases should be considered under the International Convention Against Torture. It's a kind of torture. So if that is the case, and given the fact that this crime is still alive, as far as the body is not found, there are sound legal reasons for considering that many cases of condor operations together with those 200,000 should be extraditable crimes.
Juan Garces, will you testify at the extradition hearing in Britain?
In the next future?
Yes.
It is my understanding that in the extradition proceedings in Europe, according to the European Convention on Extradition, it is not necessary to provide prima facie evidence, only to state that from the requesting state that the facts has been committed.
Reid Brody, very quickly, the Condor Plan, could you explain what it is and how it includes countries outside of Chile?
Well, under Operation Condor, General Pinochet conspired with leaders of, at the time, military leaders of countries like Paraguay, Uruguay, Brazil, Argentina, to mutually round up and assassinate each other's political opponents. And Operation Condor can be seen as a plan that extended to the killing of a Christian Democrat opponent of General Pinochet's in Italy, precisely to General Pinochet's visit to Spain after Franco's funeral, at which he planned the assassination of Chilean opponent Carlos Altamirano, to the Washington, D.C. car bombing in 1976 of former Foreign Minister Orlando Letelier and his American colleague Ronnie Moffitt. So it's really an international conspiracy to commit assassinations. The question is, will that be allowed in under the conspiracy charge that the Lords have left standing in this case?
We're also joined in our studio in New York by Alexa LeBlanc from the International Federation for Human Rights, which is a Paris-based group that recently conducted a study of the Chilean judicial system and concluded that rampant impunity makes it impossible for Pinochet to be judged fairly by Chilean courts. This is very interesting, considering that the Chilean president, Eduardo Frei, in Paris for a meeting of the Inter-American Development Bank, reiterated in an interview published by the Daily Le Monde yesterday that up to 80% of Chileans want Pinochet to return home. He said all conditions exist in Chile for a trial. Alexa LeBlanc, what exactly would a trial look like in Chile?
Well, one of the arguments of the Chilean authorities in London, in the Pinochet case, was that, first of all, Pinochet benefited from diplomatic immunity, but also that he should be judged in his home country. Now, we sent a fact-finding mission to Santiago during the first week of March to see if this could be possible. And the preliminary conclusions of this mission showed that it is, in fact, impossible to bring Pinochet to trial in Chile today. There are several reasons for this, several obstacles that have been put in place or that were put in place by Pinochet at the end of his reign. He is the one who, as you know, took care of the whole transition towards democracy and instored many, many institutions to safeguard his power as well as his impunity and the impunity of all the other members of the military responsible for heinous violations of human rights in Chile. More specifically, these obstacles consist in an amnesty law, which was passed in 1978. It's an amnesty law that amnesties all crimes committed between September 11th, 1973 and April 4th, 1978. There were also other obstacles, such as the competence of the military justice.
Well, let me ask you this. The Chilean president said 80% of Chileans want Pinochet to return home. Is that the sense you had from your study there?
From our study, we got the sense that 70% of the Chilean population wanted Pinochet to be judged. We never got the sense that 80% wanted them to go home. And the fact of the matter is, with the reactions that have occurred since the response and the judgment of the last judgment of the law lords, shows that things are quite stable in Chile today, and that we believe that the political authorities, the public authorities, secretly are quite happy to have Pinochet in London.
We're talking to a representative of the International Federation for Human Rights, which is based in Paris. Alexa LeBlanc just completed this study of the Chilean judicial system, along with her colleagues, saying that Pinochet could not possibly be tried at home. Now, what would lead to a trial of Pinochet at home? The Chilean regime had already decided he would not be tried, so this would be simply because he was arrested in London?
Well, as you know, Frei, the Chilean president, Frei, said that he could be judged in Chile. So if Pinochet were to go home, I think the Chilean government would be obliged to try and demonstrate that there is a possibility for him to be judged there. But practically, it is impossible. Other than the amnesty laws and the high competence of the military judicial justice, as you know, Pinochet was named senator for life in March of last year, and as such benefits from total immunity.
So it would be breaking that immunity agreement to try him.
Yeah, which requires an acceptance of the Senate And the Senate is highly controlled by pro-Pinochet members. He himself named 10 members of the Senate. And this would also require him to come before the Supreme Court if ever it were to go to that stage. And the president of the Supreme Court is someone that was named by Pinochet himself.
Reed Brody, let me ask you, in London, how Human Rights Watch and other human rights groups are organizing in this next phase, which is the extradition issue, the overall extradition issue, and whether or not Jack Straw will decide that Pinochet should be extradited.
Well, clearly our plan here is to convince Jack Straw that he should go ahead with the extradition. Chile and General Pinochet supporters are already mounting a very serious campaign supported by Margaret Thatcher and the British right to harass Jack Straw into changing his decision. And we're preparing to get, as well as Amnesty International, to present materials both from a legal point of view to show the importance of the conspiracy charge, as well as information showing that tortures that were committed in Chile after 1988, although it was not as nearly as bad a situation as it had been earlier, were part of a legacy of plans to torture and assassinate political opponents put into place much earlier by General Pinochet.
And finally, Reed, what was the atmosphere yesterday in the hearing room where the law lords handed down their decision?
Well, there were a lot more people there than last time. All of the lords, former Prime Minister Callaghan, many lords who weren't there the previous time were there this time. The decision itself was quite confusing, although it conformed to what the Times of London had leaked, or what had been leaked to the Times of London 2 days earlier. So it wasn't that much of a surprise when it came out. Still, it had everybody scrambling. Pinochet supporters said they won. We felt that we had scored a big victory, certainly on the principle, even if the case itself was reduced somewhat. It was very different than it was the first time, when it was an outright victory, both on principle and for the case itself.
Will the Chilean government intervene this time in the extradition decision?
Well, the first battle, as you said, is Jack Straw will have to make a decision now as to whether the extradition case should go forward. This is what the lords have requested that he do, and this is what it's normal that he would do. And I'm sure the Chilean government, I talked to them yesterday, are going to be making submissions to Jack Straw, arguing that the crimes that are left in the case don't warrant the extradition of a former head of state. We'll obviously be arguing that even a few years of a conspiracy to commit torture is serious enough, and that it's a question of quality and not of quantity.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us, Reed Brody, Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, Juan Garces, the lawyer who will be trying Pinochet if he, in fact, is sent to Spain, and also Alexa LeBlanc from the International Federation for Human Rights based in Paris, France. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Special thanks to Robert Knight. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Brindo, dijo un chacarero, soy un chacarero astuto. Y las cabras de mi tierra me saborean el fruto.